I'm reading from Robert Alter's translation of the Hebrew Bible, which seeks to replicate some of the wordplay in the Hebrew and some of the Hebrew syntax. And so this is Genesis chapter 21, beginning at verse 1. And the Lord singled out Sarah, as he had said. And the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. And Sarah conceived and bore a son to Abraham in his old age at the set time that God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore him, Isaac. And Abraham circumcised Isaac his son when he was 8 days old, as God had charged him. And Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac his son was born to him. And Sarah said, "Laughter has God made me. Whoever hears will laugh at me." And she said, "Who would have uttered to Abraham, 'Sarah is suckling sons, for I have borne a son in his old age?'" The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. As I was preparing for today's sermon, it occurred to me that writing a sermon about laughter is a little like trying to explain a joke. Most of the time, if you have to explain a joke, it's never going to be as funny as it would have been if someone had just gotten it immediately. And if someone doesn't smile or laugh after that first explanation, the second and third explanations probably are doomed to failure. I know a number of preachers who always begin their sermons with a joke, and the congregation waits expectantly for the punchline, and they either laugh or groan. I don't begin every sermon with a joke, partly because I'm afraid that I might get the groan and not the laugh. And my approach to humor in sermons is to try to say something creative, which might be funny, and if people laugh, that's great. But if they don't laugh, then hopefully it's still creative in some way. And people won't even know that it was potentially meant to be funny. Whereas a punchline that bombs is just a punchline that bombs. There's no redeeming it. And a greater danger at the attempt to use humor in sermons is that it might be unintentionally at someone else's expense, and then the damage done by the hurtfulness of the joke is very difficult to undo. But the main reason I'm wary of beginning every single sermon with a joke is that I know that most people who are listening to sermons are hoping to hear good news. They want to hear a word of hope. They don't want to hear a stand-up comic, because many people come with their hurts, with their grief, with their deep anxiety about the state of the world. Now, admittedly, on the other end of the extreme are those preachers who have no sense of humor whatsoever. I know one preacher who is very bright. His sermons are airtight, well-crafted theological essays. And his delivery of those sermons can best be described as a high-volume monotone shout. After all, he's talking about God, so he figures he should speak with a loud voice all the time. And I only wish that was a caricature. It's not. If he only once cracked a joke, I can imagine the entire congregation sighing with relief. And as difficult it is for preachers to negotiate humor in a sermon, it can be even more challenging to talk about humor in the Bible. In today's story, Abraham and Sarah learn that they are going to have a baby. Sarah is about 91 years old in the narrative, and Abraham is already over 100. And when I was in high school, I remember a speaker at a huge youth rally be telling the story. And he said, "Imagine that grandma and grandpa called you up on the phone. And they said, 'Guess what? We're going to have a baby.'" The speaker had all of us in stitches. And there is intended humor in this narrative. And we're told that Sarah laughs inwardly. And she ends up naming her baby Yitzhak, or Isaac, which is the Hebrew word for laughter. And yet I also know that the story may or may not strike us as funny. For a couple who has gone through infertility, gone through multiple in vitro fertilizations, only to have them fail, you simply cannot say, well, don't lose hope. Think of Abraham and Sarah. That's not a helpful analogy at all. More than 40 years ago, novelist and Presbyterian minister Frederick Buechner wrote a series of lectures that were eventually published in a little book called Telling the Truth, the Gospel as Tragedy, Comedy, and Fairy Tale. In the book, Buechner wrote, the tragic is the inevitable, the comic is the unforeseeable. How can Charlie Chaplin, in his baggy pants and derby hat, foresee that though he is stood up by the girl and clobbered over the head by the policeman and hit in the kisser with a custard pie, he will emerge dapper and gallant to the end, twirling his invincible cane and twitching his invincible mustache? The tragic is the inevitable, the comic is the unforeseeable. In the Hebrew narrative itself, how could Abraham and Sarah have foreseen that after being promised that they would become the ancestors of a great nation, only to face years of infertility instead, that one day three strangers would appear with incredulous news that at long last they would have a baby? And as we go through these stories in Genesis and our journey through the narrative lectionary, in a way, everything goes back to Genesis 15, when God first promises Abraham that he will be the ancestor of many. And all along the way, there are threats to the promise. If Abraham and Sarah don't have a child, how can the promise be fulfilled? If their two grandsons, Jacob and Esau, fight and seem like they're going to kill each other, how could the promise be fulfilled? If many years later, Jacob's family is in danger of starvation in a great famine, what's going to happen to the promise? And so the plot in Genesis is the promise and then potential threats to the promise and how God, in a surprising way, allows the promise to still be fulfilled. When the laughter comes, it is not the laughter at a well-told joke with perfect timing. It is a laughter that comes from a deep, deep well of disappointment. It is the laughter of someone who, in all honesty, has completely given up on God, who has come to the realization in their minds that God is simply not relevant to real life in any shape or form. And then the unforeseeable happens. Many churches have a tradition of having a Holy Humor Sunday on the second Sunday of Easter. And from my perusal of past bulletins from Covenant in the church office, I see that you've had a tradition of a Holy Humor Sunday. And the ancient basis for that is that in raising Jesus Christ from the dead, God played the ultimate joke on the devil. And when a Holy Humor Sunday is done well, when it's not just a preacher or a liturgist telling multiple jokes one after the other, it evokes this sense of a holy laughter that really does emerge from our own deep wells of disappointment at the time when God does the thing that was utterly unexpected. In Buechner's words, holy laughter is a laughter that emerges when the prodigal son, hungry and broke, decides to go home, believing that the best that he can hope for is to be hired as a worker on his father's estate. And instead, that moment that the father sees when he's still a long distance off gives up all dignity that a man of his position would normally have, And he gathers up his robes and runs after his son and embraces him and insists that everyone celebrate with a great feast. Holy laughter emerges when Job, who is bored to death by his comforters and scratching his boils and facing the undertaker's unpaid bill for the multiple funerals of his children and entire household staff, suddenly beholds with his bloodshot eyes the one who laid the foundations of the earth and at whose work the morning stars sing for joy. Holy laughter emerges when we have our lives all planned out, but it turns out that God has other plans instead. God must have a real sense of humor, we say. And for many people, that holy laughter does indeed come from a deep place. It comes when we fear, for one reason or another, that life as we have known it is over, only to find that we've been given an entirely new life instead. I'm thinking of a man that Emma and I knew in Colorado. For years, he struggled with alcohol. He tried AA several times before he was able to have a long streak of sobriety. And when he had been sober for about a year, he lost his job. He spent weeks and weeks trying to get a new job. And with that loss of income, he was finally forced to give up his housing. And he and his wife moved across the state to live with his elderly mother. And he said that for years, people kept telling him that his life would turn around for the better once he gave up drinking. And here, after a year of sobriety, his life utterly fell apart. But after having moved back to his original roots in Western Colorado, he took part in a 72-hour spiritual retreat called The Walk to Emmaus, which recalls that passage in Luke 24 where two people are walking along the road and they are utterly despondent because Jesus has been crucified. And a stranger begins walking with them who seems completely unaware of the news of the day. And they begin talking and they begin discussing the scriptures. And then they invite the stranger to stay with them. And then that moment that the stranger breaks the bread, they finally recognize that it's Jesus, that it was Jesus all along. So our friend became one of the retreat leaders for the Walk to Emmaus, leading multiple retreats and finding that holy laughter, that deep, deep sense of joy. Holy laughter is also the laughter that emerges when the people of God do something that is utterly unexpected. Holy laughter is the laughter that breaks out when a new elder on the session of the Idlewild Presbyterian Church in Memphis, Tennessee, makes the out-of-the-box suggestion that the next time the church hosts a dinner for the unhoused, that instead of using the paper plates and napkins, that they bring out the fine china and the cloth napkins. And that's exactly what they did and have done ever since. Holy laughter is the laughter that breaks out when Nadia Bowles Weber, a Lutheran pastor who is heavily tattooed and curses like a sailor, hopes to establish a church in downtown Denver that will attract those who are normally not attracted to churches. People living on the streets, drug addicts and former addicts. And many of them do come. But among the people who also come are wealthy suburbanites in their preppy clothes, who are also longing to hear good news. And Nadia thinks to herself, well, if I'm talking about the need for the church to be fully inclusive, then I need to listen to my own sermon. Now, what is something that Covenant Presbyterian Church might do that would prompt you to laugh out loud? Let me qualify that. That would prompt you to laugh out loud with joy, with that deep, deep sense of holy laughter. What wild, wonderful, utterly unexpected thing do you think God is calling us to do next? One way or another, holy laughter awaits. All glory and praise be to our God. Amen.